The first sutta I want to talk about is the first sutta, Sutta Nipata 5.1. This is to Ajita. Ajita asks, "By what is the world shrouded? Why does it not shine? Tell me, what is its tar pit? What is its greatest fear?" The question might not be exactly obvious what he's asking, but the answer helps. The Buddha says the world is shrouded in ignorance or enveloped in ignorance. We can't clearly see because we ignore what's actually happening. The Pali word for ignorance is avijja. Vijja is to know something, and avijja is not knowing. Or ignorance. So ignorance conceals the true nature of the world. Wanting and negligence make it not shine. So the problems that we see with the world are because of our wanting or because of our neglecting things that shouldn't be neglected. Longing is its tar pit or sticky lime. I found for the Pali a number of different words. I like tar pit. If you stick your hand into a tar pit, it's dirty, it's messy, and it's hard to get your hand out. And so, what is it that gets us caught? What is it that makes us really get stuck? Longing, wanting. Desire, craving. Dukkha is its greatest fear. All of your fears basically boil down to the fact that you're afraid you'll experience dukkha vedana, unpleasant sensory sensations. They might be mental sensory sensations, they might be physical. We once made the comment that all aversion is rooted in fear. Somebody said, "I hate broccoli, but I'm not afraid of it." And I said, "Yes, you are. You're afraid if you put it in your mouth, you will experience dukkha vedana, unpleasant taste sensations." Fear is often what drives us. Fear of dukkha. Jiti continues. The streams flow everywhere. What is there to block them? Please tell me the restraint of streams. By what are they cut off, locked out, controlled? The streams would be the dukkha. Remember, we're trying to get to the far shore. We're trying to find an island safe from the flood of dukkha. And the streams of dukkha flow everywhere. Whatever streams or currents there are in the world, it is mindfulness that obstructs them and restricts them. Mindfulness is our first line of defense. We've got to actually pay attention to what's going on. There is no other way to deal with it. If you're caught in a current that you don't want to be caught in, the first thing is mindfulness. Cutting off, controlling, locking out streams is due to wisdom. So, first, we've got to be mindful of the streams. And then that's like gaining your footing in a flat, fast flowing stream. And then wisdom is like, getting out of the stream. With mindfulness, we have the ability to become aware of what's actually happening and have a better chance, therefore, of dealing with it. With that awareness, we have the ability to use our wisdom to act in ways that avoid getting caught. Right? So if you've got the wisdom but you're not paying attention, it's pretty useless. So we got to have the mindfulness first. But the mindfulness is not going to be the ultimate solution. The ultimate solution is to truly understand what's going on. Ajita then says, "Ah, wisdom and mindfulness." You can see that he's impressed and thinks this is a good idea. Then he got more questions. Now, that which is name and form, please tell me where does this all cease? Name and form is the usual translation of Namarupa. Namarupa is an interesting word. It's used in many different contexts. When it's in dependent origination, you'll often see it translated as mind and body, or mentality and materiality. Another way to translate Namarupa, which is literally name and form, is concept and manifestation. If I say to you, smartphone, that's a concept. You know what I'm talking about. You probably have one. If I wave this manifestation in front of you, you know what it is. You can conceptualize that's a smartphone, right? So concept, smartphone, manifestation. And Ajita wants to know, where does this all cease? The question you have asked, Ajita, I will answer for you. Where Namarupa completely cease? The answer is, by the cessation of consciousness, they cease. Now that's like, what? You have to go unconscious? Why would you go unconscious? I mean, I thought this whole path was about really seeing what's going on. You can't see anything that's going on if you're unconscious. I mean, you get the idea. It's weird. It doesn't make any sense if it's going unconscious. So what's going on here? Well, there's a sutta that tells us a lot. The phrase, the cessation of consciousness, actually shows up in eight different suttas. If you go to my website and click on the Buddha and then look down the little menu, you'll find Index of Suttas. That's indexes of topics, people, and places. I've been generating them. I have over 150 of them. And one of them I generated was cessation of consciousness. That's how come I know there are eight suttas. And one of those suttas is Dīghanikāya number 11, long discourse number 11. It's actually quite an interesting sutta. It's two discourses jammed together to make one sutta. The first one is on the gradual training. I got a book on that. You can read about it there. Okay. The second one is about a monk who wants to know where the four elements cease without remainder. And so he gets real concentrated and goes up to the lowest heaven and asks. And they say, "We don't know. Ask the guys upstairs." And he asks them, and they don't know. And up he goes through the heavens until he finally gets to ask Brahma, "Where do the four elements cease without remainder?" Brahma says, "You look like a Buddhist monk. Go ask the Buddha." "I don't know." So the monk comes back down to the human realm and asks the Buddha. And the Buddha says, "You've asked your question wrong. This is how the question should be put. Where do earth, water, fire, and air no footing find? Where are long and short, small and great, beautiful and ugly? Where are name and form totally brought to an end?" The answer is consciousness that is signless, limitless, and all illuminating. That's where earth, water, fire, and air no footing find. They're both long and short, small and great, beautiful and ugly. Their name and form are totally brought to an end. With the cessation of consciousness, all this is brought to an end. Okay. I'm going to leave the cessation of consciousness until we go through the other part of the answer because that will help. Consciousness that is signless. Right? So the signs are how we recognize something. For example, can you all see the bird and the flowers? You nod your heads if you see the bird and the flowers. Yeah, bird and flowers, right? No, you see pixels. Actually, you see pixels making colored shapes. There's no bird or flowers here. It's just colored shapes. But the colored shapes are signs of birds and flowers. Right? You know it's a bird because it's got that particular shape. That shape is a sign of a bird. And you know those are all flowers because, yeah, flowers are kind of round and they got the little fluffy petals and so forth. Those are signs of flowers. When you take the colored shapes and make them into bird and flowers, that's sanya. Sanya is usually translated as perception. It's one of the five khandhas. But a more accurate translation, I think, is conceptualization. You are conceptualizing these colored shapes as bird and flowers. So we need consciousness that's signless. What the Buddha is saying is that Nama Rupa comes to an end with consciousness that's not using signs to conceptualize. If you can do that, you realize that normally what we're doing is interacting with the world of concepts. We don't actually experience the world. We experience our concepts. We do experience, yeah, light hitting our eyes and making colored shapes, but we quickly conceptualize it into bird and flowers or tree or person or whatever. And then we're interacting with our concepts all the time. But if you don't conceptualize and still remain conscious, you can realize how totally caught up we are in interacting with our concepts instead of reality. If you don't conceptualize and can still remain conscious, it's like you're experiencing the world raw without adding conceptualization on top of it. This is consciousness that's signless. This is where we're trying to get to with Atamayata, not concocting, not fabricating the world. Now, if you can do that, it's limitless because you're not conceptualizing any limits. You realize it's like this everywhere, even in the places where there's no current sensory input. If there's no current sensory input, there are no signs. That's pretty easy. And where there is currently a sensory input, you're not conceptualizing. So no signs happening there. And it's also all illuminating in the sense that you realize it's like this everywhere. Yes, you cannot see the whole universe, but you see that if I don't conceptualize what's going on, I see the universe raw, and it's going to be like that everywhere. It's going to be, well, like the Bahia Sutta, if you're familiar with that. We'll get into that in some detail. In seeing, there's just seeing. Hearing, just hearing. Sensing, just sensing. Cognizing, just cognizing. If you can do this, you have stopped thingifying the world. Mostly we go around and whatever we see, we make a thing out of it. We take the world and divide it up into things. We sort of need to do that because you got to find some things to eat. You got to find some things to wear and so forth. It's a useful thing to do, but it sort of shrouds what's going on at a deeper level, and we wind up only interacting with our concepts. The only thing you've ever seen in your life is neurological activity in your visual cortex. You've never actually seen a tree. You've never touched a tree. All you've ever done is feel the pressure sensors in your hand. As you see yourself touching the tree based on the neurological activity in your visual cortex. Sometimes our conceptualizations are accurate. I suspect most times you saw a tree, it was actually a tree. Most times you touched a tree, it probably was really a tree. But a lot of times our conceptualizing is not accurate. And this is what gets us into trouble. The name and form, the conceptualizing and manifesting that we do experience comes to an end with consciousness that is signless, limitless, and all illuminating. Because then dualities come to an end. Water, earth, fire, and air find no footing, long and short, small and large, beautiful and ugly, concept and manifestations all come to an end. Because you're not conceptualizing. This is tall, this is short, that's beautiful, this is ugly. You're not getting attached to the signs. You're conscious, but it's signless consciousness. Finally, there is that strange sentence, with the cessation of consciousness, all this comes to an end. The word consciousness is vijnana, which we translate as consciousness, but it's literally divided knowing. For example, if you look at this black thing right between the two lenses in my glass, look carefully, really look at it. Now become aware of what's in your peripheral vision. What's in your peripheral vision was there all along. You just weren't conscious of it. You were so focused in on this thing that I distracted you with that you weren't conscious of it. But then when I mentioned your peripheral vision, you divided this from what's in your peripheral vision, and you became aware of what's in your peripheral vision. With the cessation of dividing knowing, with the cessation of chopping the world up into bits and pieces, thingifying the world, that's where Nama-rupa comes to an end. You can do this with consciousness that is signless. You do this with consciousness that's not getting lost in concepts that are created by the signs of things. So you're not dividing your awareness up based on the signs. This is consciousness is signless. This is kind of tricky. I understand about it. And there is no way I can say anything that you're going to go, oh, yeah, I totally know what you're talking about. The only way you're going to totally know what I'm talking about is to have the experience. The practices that the Buddha is giving us and that we're going to give you on this retreat are aimed at leading you in the direction of that experience so that at some point you can experience the world signlessly, limitlessly, all illuminating. Okay, so to finish this sutta, Ajita asks, for those who fully understood the Dhamma, those who are training and other individuals here, explain their conduct. So he's saying, all right, those who fully understood the Dhamma, those who are fully awakened, they've gotten to the ultimate understanding of the Dhamma, the teachings of the Buddha. Dhamma can also mean phenomena. Could be mind objects. I suspect it's the teaching of the Buddha, or maybe phenomena. So for those who have fully understand the Dhamma, and those who are training to fully understand the Dhamma, and the other people here, explain their conduct. How do they behave? Not craving for sensual pleasures, and with a mind that is pure and tranquil, one should mindfully go forth, skilled in all situations. Part of being skilled in all situations is understanding the phenomenal world and not being fooled by your conceptualizing. The idea isn't that you never conceptualize. You obviously have to conceptualize to find something to eat. Buddhists obviously conceptualize. He ate with his hand. But he never ate his fingers. He was conceptualizing the difference between the food and the fingers. Okay? But he wasn't fooled by his conceptualizing. That's what we're after, to experience the world from time to time without concepts, just experiencing it raw. When we can do so, there's no thing to crave or cling to. Hence, the end of dukkha. Okay, so this is the first sutta. I want to share with you the sixth sutta, which is on a similar theme, and we'll go through it. I'll give you a practice to do between now and tomorrow morning, and then we'll throw it open for questions. So if what I said wasn't unclear, was unclear, I apologize, but you're going to get a chance to maybe we can clear it up. So the next sutta is given to Upasiva. This is quite an interesting sutta from a, well, from a scholarly viewpoint. Upasiva asks, one with all-round vision, tell me an object supported by which I may cross over this flood. So tell me how to meditate such that it supports me that I can cross over this flood of dukkha, that I can cross to the far shore, that I can make my way to an island. The Buddha's answer is having regard for no thingness, possessing mindfulness, Upasiva, supported by it does not exist, cross over the flood. So Upasiva wants a basis, foundation, support, object that he should practice to escape dukkha. And the Buddha answers that one should mindfully observe no thingness. This is very controversial in that the ancient commentary, the Nidesa, and a number of prominent scholars interpret the no thingness as the seventh jhana, which is called the base of no thingness, or the realm of no thingness, or the experience of no thingness. But it's two different words. The word for the base of no thingness has ayatana on the end of it. If you know a little bit of Pali, you might recognize ayatana as the eye and its sights, the ear and its sounds. It's the organs and their objects. We don't have that concept in English. We have the eye and the objects as being separate. But in Pali, there's the ayatana of the eye, which includes the eye and its sights, the ayatana of the ear organ and its sounds. And so this is the nothingness ayatana. And I think in this instance, we could call it the experience of no thingness, but it's the seventh jhana. It's a specific mental state, and it's a different word than what's used in the sutta. The one in the sutta doesn't have ayatana associated with it. Every place in the suttas where it's talking about the seventh jhana, it uses the word ayatana at the end of the description. And this is something different. Here, the Buddha is referring to the no thingness, no thingifying of atamayata. Atamayata is non-concocting, non-fashioning, or literally not made of this. Again, not thingifying, not conceptualizing. It's that stopping before you get lost in your concept. And so what the Buddha is saying is having regard for nothingness. And this is looking more at the not just not conceptualizing, but realizing that the things of the world are our concepts and that what's out there. Well, what's out there is actually verbs. I heard a talk by Joseph Goldstein one time, and he said, you should think of yourself as a verb rather than a noun. I thought that was pretty good. Because yeah, we're a bunch of processes. You're a circulatory process and a digestive process and an endocrine process. You're a collection of processes. And then I got to thinking about it, and I realized it's all processes. There aren't any nouns. It's just that some verbs move kind of slow, and we think they're nouns. I mean, this noun, smartphone, right? Yeah, well, it's only temporarily a smartphone. It used to be silicon and plastic, yeah, dinosaurs, glass, rubber case, metal, right? In some sweatshop in China, they put it all together. And somebody in Silicon Valley wrote the software, and then it became a smartphone, which is what it is right now. It's useful to call it a smartphone. Like if I can't find it, I can say to my friend, "Where's my smartphone?" Right? It's a useful concept, but that's not what's really there. What's really here is a process that's moving very slowly because eventually this is going to become electronic waste and it'll get recycled. Maybe next time it'll turn into, I don't know, a hearing aid. Or a computer, or a bunch of stuff. It's the same thing with, say, think of four vertical pieces of wood, all the same length, and a great big flat piece of wood on top of the vertical pieces. We call this a table, but it's actually just a bunch of trees. Maybe it's only one tree, but it's tree. The tree was cut down and milled into this shape and attached this way, and now we call it a table. But when you look at the table, do you see the trees? Do you see the birds roosting in the trees? Do you see the insects being eaten by the birds roosting in the trees? Do you see the sunlight, the rain, the minerals in the earth? That's all there in those trees. Nah, you just conceptualize a table, a noun. But the table's going to wear out. And if there's a flood and it comes floating by, it's a life raft. It stops being a table. You conceptualize it differently. Or if you desperately need firewood, it's a source of firewood rather than a table. And eventually it's going to be worn out and probably burned, and carbon dioxide will go back into the air and be breathed in by some trees. It's all in motion, it's all moving. It's just that some things are moving relatively slow at the human time scales, and some things are moving quite fast at human time scales. And if it's moving quite fast, we call it a verb. And if it's moving kind of slow, we call it a noun. That's it. So, having regard for nothingness, the fact that it's not solid things. Possessing mindfulness, supported by it does not exist. It's not a thing. The best we can say, yeah, it's a verb, but the verb is still a concept. Now, you've got to have mindfulness with this, the Buddha says. If you're in the seventh jhana, yes, you are mindful of nothingness. But that's not a state in which you're going to gain any insight or be able to cross the flood. But if you're paying attention to the world and not conceptualizing things as nouns, then you can be mindful. Then you have a chance to actually see what's going on, and supported by it does not exist. The table does not exist at the ultimate level. It's just a history of some trees. That's how you cross the flood. Okay. Thinking that it's the seventh jhana completely misses the very deep teaching here. The mindfulness and it does not exist on top of the no thingness is a liberating practice. And it's basically the same thing that was given to Ajita in the first sutta we looked at. Sujato translates it, mindfully contemplating no thingness, depending on the perception there is no thing. Right? So instead of our usual way of perceiving the world, can you perceive the world? There aren't things. And the first step is they're only verbs. At the most profound level, all the things are just our concepts. And even at the conventional level, it turns out there are no independent things in the entire universe. Everything at the conventional level arises dependent on other things. And those other things also arise dependent on still other things until at last we find an all-encompassing vast net of dependencies. It's not that everything is connected to everything else, it's that everything is connected to enough other things so that we have a net. A net doesn't have every node tied to every node, it just has every node tied to enough other nodes that it makes a unitary structure. This is the same for, well, we could say the net of existence. Nothing has independent existence. When we carve the world up into bits and pieces, when we're thingifying our experience, we're missing the bigger picture. We have to carve it up into bits and pieces in order to get something to eat and clothes to wear and a place to live, etc. But this is relative view of the world. And as Nagarjuna says, we have to look at the world from the absolute perspective if we're going to find freedom. So it's not that nothing exists. It's that the things that we're concocting in the world, conceptualizing, aren't the full picture. Nagarjuna's word for relative truth is truth that doesn't fully reveal. So truths seen from the relative perspective don't fully reveal what's going on. So mindfully regard no thingness, supported by it does not exist, cross over the flood, leaving behind sensual pleasures, abstaining from chatter, watch for the destruction of craving day and night. Giving up sensual pleasures. That's hard. I'm a greed type. When I first came to Buddhism and they said, yeah, sensual pleasures bad. Well, maybe they didn't put it like that, but that's how I heard it. It was like, I don't know if I can buy that. But they had enough other good stuff going on that I was willing to stick around and see. And it's not that the pleasure is bad. It's the pursuit of the pleasure that's bad. The craving for the pleasures, the clinging to whatever we think is going to give us pleasures. Just leave it behind. There are multiple suttas, and I do mention the suttas in the book, where it's Nibbana is talked about as blissful, ultimately pleasurable. It's not like there won't be any more pleasure in your life when you become fully awakened. Apparently, all there will be in your life is pleasure. You don't have anything interrupting it, like dukkha. Okay? But the pursuit of pleasures is what causes the problem, because that's the craving and clinging. If you're craving it and you don't get it, dukkha. If you're craving it and you get it, and you're clinging to it and you're worried about losing it. Dukkha. If you can see that most of the sensual pleasures only have momentary reward, you can let it go. You're craving what? Chocolate cake, right? And you get a piece of chocolate cake. And the piece of chocolate cake, when you eat it, gives you pleasure for what, 6 or 7 hours? No? 2 hours? 30 minutes? 10 minutes? Yeah, not much. And you still got to deal with the fact that you ate all that sugar and, whatever it's doing to you. So, abandoning the pursuit of sensual pleasures is what's going to be necessary to cross over the flood. Refraining from chatter. The word actually means talk, speech, conversation, discussion, argument, debate, literally talk. I think chatter is a good translation. That's from Sujato. There are multiple suttas in Book 4 of the Sutta Nipata that recommend refraining from arguing. When you're arguing, what does it do to your state of mind? Do you feel more peaceful and relaxed while you're arguing? Or does it have some other effect? And how often do you convince the person that you're arguing with to adopt your viewpoint? I suspect that if I were to take a poll of all of you asking you how many arguments have you won on social media, I can guess the sum total of the answers. Zero. Yeah. So the Buddha's not saying that you shouldn't talk. He said to the monks and nuns that they should talk about the Dharma or keep notable silence. When we're talking, it should be useful talk. Okay, it may not be about the Dharma because we're not monks and nuns, but it should be at least useful. But how much talk in this world is there that's useless? They're uploading so many hours of video to YouTube every day that it's impossible to keep up. You couldn't even watch 1% of it. And how much of it is useful? Right? There's a lot of endless chatter going on. Just noise. Right? Refrain from that. When you need to communicate, then do that by all means. Don't get lost in it. And of course, in a number of suttas where right speech is defined, one of the defining characteristics is refraining from idle chatter. You've probably heard that before. And then watch day and night for the ending of craving. When craving arises, you need to notice it and let it go. Noticing it is, well, it's possible. You can really get in there. If you're really determined, you can notice when the craving arises. Letting it go may be more difficult, all right? Sometimes you're going to be able to let it go. Sometimes you don't want to let it go. Okay, well, maybe it's a setup for dukkha. It's always going to be a setup for dukkha. Maybe it brings dukkha, maybe it doesn't. But you're probably not going to get to the place where craving doesn't arise till you get to at least the third stage of awakening. So you're going to have to deal with the fact that it keeps arising. What the Buddha is saying is watch for the ending of it. Watch for it and make it end. Right? Sometimes you succeed, great. No more dukkha from that. Sometimes you don't. Well, we're not there yet. Keep working. Upasiva has a further question. One whose passion for sensual pleasures has gone and is supported by no thingness, having left the other, the thingified world behind, being released in the highest release from perception, conceptualization, would they stay there not subject to samsara? In other words, if I can get all the way to the island, can I stay on the island? The Buddha answers, one whose passion for all sensual pleasures has gone, Upasiva, supported by no thingness, having left the other behind, a thingified world, being released in the ultimate liberation from conceptualizing, they would stay there, not subject to samsara. If you can get to that point, you will have experienced the world in such a way that you can stay. This breakthrough is irreversible. You have experienced the world and there is no going back. That's pretty good. You can get a sense of this if when you were a kid, you believed in Santa Claus. Yeah, I remember believing in Santa Claus. I had my suspicions, you know, and then something happened and, oh, confirmed, it's just mommy and daddy. There was no going back. You know, I couldn't start believing in Santa Claus anymore. I had enough evidence. I was completely reprogrammed. Okay, that's a trivial reprogramming. The making it to the island, that's a very profound reprogramming. If you can fully do that, you're safe. If one should remain there not subject to samsara for a vast number of years, asked Upasiva, and being released in that very place were to become cold, would consciousness disappear for one in such a state? In other words, if you can get there, when you die, does your consciousness disappear? And that consciousness here is not the divided knowing that we talked about earlier. This is just a regular consciousness that you think about. So what happens to the consciousness of one who's fully awakened when they die? The Buddha's answer, just as a flame tossed by the force of the wind goes out and no longer counts as a flame, so a sage released from their mental body goes out and no longer counts as a sage. It's quite possible to ask questions that seem to make a lot of sense that actually on closer examination don't make any sense at all. So what is the consciousness like of an enlightened person after they die? Seems like a reasonable question. There was a wanderer named Vajragota who came to the Buddha a number of times asking questions. And once he came and asked, Venerable Sir, what happens to a liberated one after death? Do they exist? Do they not exist? Do they both exist and not exist? Do they neither exist or not exist? The Buddha said, Avajja, if there was a little fire burning here, would you know it? Oh, yes, sir, Venerable Sir. If we put more sticks on the fire, what would happen? It would blaze up and get bigger. What if you don't put any more sticks on the fire? Well, it would go out. Vajragota, when the fire goes out, which way does it go? North, south, east, west, up, down? Venerable Sir, the question makes no sense. It just goes out. It's the same for an awakened one. Any means by which an awakened one might be described has been given up, cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, obliterated, unable to arise in the future. An awakened one is freed from reckoning in terms of any of the five aggregates, including consciousness. You can't say anything about the consciousness of an awakened one after death. It just doesn't make any sense. It's like asking, where does your lap go when you stand up? My grandmother asked me that. You know, I stood up and I pointed to where, well, came my lap when I sat down. But she said, but that's not a lap. That's just your legs. Yeah, where does your lap go when you stand up? It seems to make sense. Asking like which way the fire goes out is just like asking what happens to the consciousness of one who's liberated. You can't say anything about it. It's a concept. The consciousness of a liberated one is also a concept, right? Is a verb, not a noun. Buddha got old, sick, and died. That happens to everybody, but we can't say anything about his consciousness. In Majjhima 38, there's a misguided bhikkhu named Sati who thinks that his consciousness transmigrates, that when you die, your consciousness goes and finds a new body. This is pretty common. Some monks hear about this. They go to Sati and they say, "Is this true? This is what you think the Buddha teaches?" And Sati says, "Yes, as I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, that's what he's teaching." And they say, no, he said consciousness independently originated, but Sati wouldn't give up his pernicious view. So the monks went to the Buddha, told him what happened. The Buddha says, "Tell Sati the master calls." So that monk tells Sati, and Sati comes to see the Buddha. The Buddha asks, "Sati, what is consciousness?" Sati replies, "Is that which speaks and feels and experiences here and there the results of good and bad actions." So, is this a good definition of consciousness? I mean, speaking is sometimes called speaking your mind. So that would be your consciousness is speaking, right? Yeah. It feels, you feel thirsty, you drink some water, you feel pleasure. It's your consciousness that's doing that feeling, right? And of course, it experiences the results of good and bad actions. It gets the karmic resultants. So, is this a good description of consciousness? The Buddha replies, "You misguided man, when have you ever known me to teach Dhamma like that? For on many occasions I have said that consciousness is dependently originated, for without supporting conditions there is no origination of consciousness." The Buddha then asked the monks if they think Sati is right, and they reply, "No, venerable sir, you have taught many times that consciousness is dependently originated." The Buddha says that consciousness is reckoned by the conditions on which it depends. If it arises dependent on the eye and sight objects, it's eye consciousness. Ear and sounds, ear consciousness. Nose and smell, nose consciousness. Tongue and taste, tongue consciousness. Body and textures, body consciousness. Mind and mind objects, mind consciousness. Just like a fire is reckoned by the condition on which it depends. If it's burning on a house, it's reckoned as a house fire. In a forest, it's a forest fire. Rubbish, it's a rubbish fire. Chaff, it's a chaff fire. Logs, it's a log fire. Cow dung, it's a cow dung fire. It's the same with consciousness. It requires a condition on which it depends, either five sense input or input from your mind. It's not that there are six types of consciousness. That's a later misunderstanding. There are six ways of thinking about consciousness, just like there's multiple ways of thinking about fire. We say house fire, forest fire, rubbish fire, right? It's still heat and fuel uniting with oxygen, right? That's fire. Okay, and then we reckon it, we talk about it, we think of it, but it's still fire in all those cases. When a fire goes out, which way does it go? When consciousness goes out, you can't say which way it goes either. It's just like the fire. The fire arises because of causes and conditions. Consciousness arises because of causes and conditions. When there are no more supporting conditions for a fire, we say it's gone out. When there are no more supporting conditions for consciousness, we say it's gone out, if we're going to be accurate. Now, the sutta continues with the Buddha asking a series of questions and answers about dependent origination. It goes on for page after page after page. It's one of the most tedious passages in all of the suttas. I suspect it's a later insertion. It reads like a catechism. Remember catechism from Sunday school, maybe? So it's just a series of question and answers, and the monks are getting it all right, but it's really boring to read. I mean, read it once, but then you can skip to the heart of the matter. At Majjhima 38.23, Buddha says, "Bhikkhus, knowing and seeing in this way, that is, in terms of dependent origination, would you run back to the past wondering, Were we in the past? Were we not in the past? What were we in the past? How were we in the past? Having been what? What did we become in the past? No, venerable sir. Knowing and seeing in this way, would you run forward to the future, wondering, shall we be in the future? Shall we not be in the future? What shall we be in the future? How shall we be in the future? Having been what shall we become in the future? No, venerable sir. Knowing and seeing in this way, would you be inwardly perplexed about the present thus? Am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where has this being come from? Where will it go? No, venerable sir. Because are you saying this just because I'm your teacher? No, venerable sir. Because are you saying this because you know it from your own experience? Yes, venerable sir. If you truly understand dependent origination at the deepest level, then you don't think about what was I in the past, what will I be in the future, or even what am I now. You realize that you are nothing but the intersection of a bunch of streams of dependently arising processes interacting, which I call SODAPI, SODAPI, streams of dependently arising processes interaction, which just happens to be the subtitle of my book on dependent origination and emptiness. You can download it and read it for free. But that's all there is SODAPI. Just processes interacting. That's it. The idea of there being a self, a being, it doesn't occur. If a self is not conceived of, then the questions like, what was I in the past or what shall I be in the future, don't arise. For example, if you understand that the earth is a sphere, then the question, if someone falls off the edge of the earth, does it hurt? Just doesn't arise. I mean, it sounds like a good question. If you fall off the edge of the earth, you might land on something. Does that hurt? Or if you don't land, I mean, you just keep falling faster and faster. You fall so fast that the air friction sets you on fire. That would hurt. Or do you just keep falling and you like starve to death? That'd hurt. And you wonder, does it hurt if you fall off the edge of the world? If you understand that the earth is a sphere, the question doesn't arise. It makes no sense. The question of what was I in the past? What will I be in the future? Don't arise if you deeply understand dependent origination. You are not so deluded that you think it's possible to fall off the edge of the world. A liberated one has overcome the delusion of self, so those self-referencing past and future questions don't arise. This is what liberation is about. Just letting go. Realizing that you're just the intersection point for a bunch of dependently arising processes that are interacting. You're not independent. You're completely dependent on air pressure, 14 and a half pounds per square inch, 1 kilo per square centimeter. That's quite a lot, actually. Even if you had an oxygen tube in your mouth and the air pressure disappeared, you wouldn't last very long. It would be most unpleasant. I mean, you may think that your body ends at the edge of your sense of touch, but the air pressure is keeping you alive. You're not independent of that. That's part of you just as much as the heart is a part of you. You're not independent of food. I doubt any of you grow your own food. Right? You're dependent on the grocery store having food and the people who brought the food to the grocery store and the farmers who grew the food and the people that picked the food. And all that's part of the streams of dependently arising processes interacting. You're not independent of electricity. If electricity were to completely disappear on the continent on which you live, you'd be lucky to last a couple weeks. You'd die if you weren't hanging out with people who are living with subsistence agriculture. We are completely dependent on electricity. Once you start overcoming the thinginess of the world. Once you stop thingify, you start seeing the flow of verbs. And then you realize that actually all the verbs are dependent on other verbs. And there's really only one verb, unfolding. We could say the universe is unfolding, but the universe is superfluous. There's just unfolding. When you can do that, the question about what happens to an enlightened one after death just doesn't arise because there's just this giant unfolding. That's all that's happening. That's all you are, is that you're a piece of the unfolding. Fully awakened ones have realized that, and they're not conceiving of themselves in the past or the future or even the present. They're not identifying with the unfolding either. Don't make that mistake. That's the last refuge. Okay, I'm not that. I'm not that. I'm at least the unfolding. No, you're not the unfolding. It's much bigger than you. You'd have to be as big as the universe to be the unfolding. And I can tell by just looking at you, none of you are big as the universe. Okay, so Upasiva still got another question. One who has gone out, do they exist or they remain unimpaired forever? Explain this well to me, sage, for this doctrine is known by you. Upasifa still wants to know what happens after death to an awakened one. He was just told that asking about their consciousness makes no sense. Now he wants to know if they still exist or not. Nonsense questions are endless. Where does your voice go when you stop speaking? Where does your consciousness go in deep dreamless sleep? These are questions about nouns, and what's going on is verbs. They don't make any sense. The Buddha replies, there's no measuring one who has gone out, Upasiva. That no longer exists for them by which one might speak of them. When all phenomena have been removed, then all ways of speaking are also removed. One who's come to the end of the path cannot be defined. There's nothing by which others might describe them. When all conceiving of things has been eradicated, all ways of speech are also eradicated. Nagarjuna, in his teachings on emptiness, talks about the ultimate as indescribable, inconceivable, indivisible. You can't describe the ultimate because to describe anything, you have to use concepts. The ultimate is beyond concepts. It's inconceivable. You can't conceive of it. You can only get a sense of it. But you can't conceptualize it. And it turns out it's indivisible. There are no bits and pieces. It's just unfolding, this giant unfolding. Once you grok the full holistic nature of the ultimate universe, you do understand it, but you can't talk about it in any way because any word you use is a concept and it's beyond concepts. The indescribable, inconceivable, indivisible nature of the universe doesn't lend itself to concepts, just the unfolding. So, what I think the Buddha is teaching here is if you can do the Bahya practice in seeing, just seeing, and hearing, just hearing, and sensing, and just sensing, then what you experience is just the unfolding. There are no things. You stop looking at the world in terms of nouns. You start seeing processes. And then you move beyond processes and realize they're all interconnected, too, and eventually there's just unfolding. But even unfolding is just one more concept, one more concocting, one more fashioning. We have to get beyond even that to the indescribable, inconceivable, indivisible. We have to get to Atamayata. So, how do we get there? Well, the Bahya practice is a really good start. And so I'm going to give you a practice to do that is derived from the Bahia practice. So what the Buddha says to Bahia is, in seeing, there is only seeing, in hearing, only hearing, in sensing, only sensing, in cognizing, only cognizing. When you can do that, Bahia, know you in that, know you in this, know you in between, just this is the end of dukkha. So I'm going to give you a walking practice. You want to go out for a walk. You can do this walking back and forth, but I suggest going for a walk. You want to go for a walk someplace where you don't have to navigate yourself back. In other words, you know the way back. You've done it for enough so you're familiar. You don't have to keep looking for landmarks. And where there are no tree roots or rocks in the path that you need to look out for, where you can just walk. And you want to walk along and open up your peripheral vision and see, can you just see not trees and cars and houses, but see the visual field? You're not seeing things other than the visual field, right? And if you can get to that and get it steady, I mean, you'll fall in and out of it, obviously, but if you can get it, all right, yeah, I think I got this, then can you step back one more step to just seeing, seeing? Right? And you want to do at the same time hearing. Don't hear car or airplane or bird, just hear sounds, just hear the auditory field. And then step back even further to just hearing, hearing. And for sensing, you're walking along, so you'll be able to sense your feet, sense touching the earth with each step, right? Okay, so instead of sensing your steps, you just sense the touch field. There's just sensations. When you can get this going well, all that's happening is that you're seeing, seeing, you're hearing, hearing, your feet are going up and down and generating sensations you sense, and the world is coming past you. When it's going well for me, I'm not moving. My feet are moving. I can feel the different sensations there. But I'm still, and the world is coming past me visually, and the sounds are happening around me. So start simply. You don't have to start with seeing. It may be easier for you to work with auditory or sensing, right? But you want to get to the place where you're not experiencing things, but you're experiencing the sensory field. You're seeing the sensory field, and step back again further to see just seeing. And the same for the others. As for the cognizing, I would say, yeah, wait on that. Get good at those first three. When the cognizing happens, basically all it is, the thought comes through and you just watch the thought go through and it's gone. You didn't jump on it. No, the thought train came in, but it didn't stop at the station and you didn't get on it, right? But don't worry about the thoughts as you're trying to learn this practice.